During rehearsal yesterday, I said, Nick, expect applause when the D-wobbler kicks in. And it sure was. These are exercises in practical science. And we want to preserve our stuff. It's a very practical set of considerations we have to approach. And so we're doing the best we can, doing it without big money, without any sort of support. And we're happy to continue doing it that way. We do have time for questions. Kurt.
A couple things. First of all, just to make a slight correction, the RQ phone is still available.
Okay.
Aside from that, I really applaud both Nick and John for what they're doing. That is really, really cool. One thing that was not, I'm sorry.
Be preserved.
One thing that you guys kind of...
Okay, there we go. All right. One thing you guys were talking about kind of tangentially but really didn't address was stylus size. And I've noticed in playing my archaeophone that sometimes I can see visible wear depending on what type of stylus, the configuration, the shape, and the size is being used to play that recording. And you guys were talking 7.5, 8, so forth. I was just wondering if all of you have kind of settled on a particular size and shape of stylus for playing brown wax records, or what your recommendation is on that.
Before John takes it with the specific answer, let's not assume that cleaning the cylinder is wearing the cylinder. Because you can see differences after you play a dirty cylinder, and that's just a function of cleaning off whatever residue is exuded out of it over the years. So again, let's just to make that distinction. John.
You have a microphone.
Well, that's true. Yeah. I just want to be able to see Kurt. David potentially opened up a whole dog leg there about playing clean media. And I always have a very worn old cotton t-shirt nearby when I'm listening to new stuff. I also would encourage people who are, you know, worried about any kind of washing to try distilled water. It really works well. But to your question, I think there is some difference in groove geometry that I've noted on brown wax. So I do have some options, but typically I start with the 8x4 mil and go from there. It's very hard sometimes to go to other sizes, and they sometimes sound better, but that can be very deceiving. In certain early brown wax cylinders, I go with a narrower side-to-side ratio of 6 mils, because I found that they're cut differently. If you care, those are early New Englands. But pretty much start with an 8x4. Does that help?
Nick, am I correct that the mandrel, the flywheel, and the vertical motor move up and down together as an ensemble?
Exactly, yeah.
Then,
exactly.
How does the ensemble move up and down? Do you use pneumatic servo drives?
I can demonstrate real quick, maybe? Yeah. Is there a way to get back to it, or?
I don't know.
Okay.
Oh, this is a Mac. How do you use that?
Oh, you're close. Yeah. Go to the D-wobble one, maybe.
The reason I ask is I saw the gas bottle underneath it, and I thought you use the gas as this in order to drive the servos.
Yeah. So this is a high-tech linear slide here. So it's like let me see in the back here. Let's go to actually a still image, maybe better. Yeah, hold on a second, I get to it. Okay. Yeah, so this entire structure here is moving up and down on the Z slide in the back. And so sort of pull that off is not that easy, because it's like 9 pounds or so that has to move up and down, and it has to be able to control that very accurately. Oh, thanks.
There's your first pull quote. Yeah.
I just have a thank you and a quick comment. First of all, thank you for a fascinating whole presentation. I think we all learned a huge amount, and there's a lot to think about into the future. Rebecca, thank you especially for new research. I just wanted to say from Syracuse University in 2003, the Belfer Audio Archive, as many people in this room, had been shut down for over 11 years. There was no one there at that time who knew anything about transferring cylinders. I don't know who you're quoting, but it wasn't anybody who actually had any experience with working with cylinders. There was a project that was being done from our engineering department in the university, but they had actually no practical experience with working with cylinders. It was no one who would have been at ARSC. So I just want to state that be careful to always quote who you're working with, quoting at a university, not just a whole university, okay? Okay, thanks.
It wouldn't be the first time that management and practitioners have not spoken to each other.
Hi, David.
Hey, Seth.
Bottom line, Kurt and you gentlemen, what's the cost of these machines? We haven't heard a price this whole morning so far.
Talking to the mics, yeah, it should be loud.
Yeah. This is a prototype. I'm not in production yet, and I don't know specific pricing. I would suggest if you're interested in the machine, go to cps1.net. It's just a web page, and there's a contact form there, and just send me a note so I know you're out there, and I'll keep you posted. Basically, there are going to be a couple permutations offered, probably. The machine you're seeing, the prototype, has a built-in, very high-quality non-RIAA preamp. And that's probably going to be an option in the production model. Probably the basic machine is going to start somewhere in the $12,000 to $13,000 range.
Oh, I meant to ask one other thing. What about maintenance on these machines?
None. I mean, everything, this thing is built to just run. I mean, it doesn't require any maintenance. Obviously, you need, there are obvious care requirements, and cartridges are very fragile, but it's built to just keep working.
Nick?
There's a few different options, so the basic one I would say would be less than an Archaeophone, and maybe the middle one about the same Archaeophone, and then with the D-wobble and everything, it gets a little expensive, so it's more. I haven't figured that out exactly, but I would say 20, 30, and 40, something like that. Yeah.
Other questions? Peter.
Hi, this is Peter Alley from the Library of Congress. I wanted to make a couple notes. One was the spectrogram of the image of the cylinder that was optically done, that you identified some phantom tones or whatever.
Yes.
I just want to say that I've done a lot of scans and have not had phantom tones, so I'm not sure exactly what happened there, but that's not a regular problem with scanning. It's not like you always get phantom tones. Also, the discussion of the bit depth, you can create the other 12 bits of noise, but it is noise in the case of a cylinder, and it's not self-noise in the optical system. The optical system self-noise is very similar, if not a little less, than a cartridge and tone arm and preamp and things like that. So you can create that, but it is just noise. It's not signal. And I did have a question about the wear study. I was curious because the sweep, as it goes up, you can see on the spectrogram that the amplitude drops off as you would expect. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you did any correction to deal with the fact that you're not getting flat across the frequency range to deal with that problem.
No. No corrections, totally flat.
I have a question for Rebecca and a question for Nick. Do you have anything that you can tell us about the other data points that you were measuring, the fixed tones, the broadband, and particularly the higher frequencies of the sweep, what happens after multiple plays, if the initial reproduction is the 9K, how does that?
Well, individually, each cylinder is unique, and I found interesting things that happened in test signals across the three cylinders in different test tones. For example, when Jerry played his cylinder on the period phonograph, some of those high frequencies actually came back just in that one cylinder. It was just this weird anomaly that happened, and then it just went away again. So things like that happened, and specifically in the other test tones, I just for this presentation, I just totally focused on just those signs. It's in my thesis. It's on the NYU website. Yeah.
For Nick, the issue of the flywheel and the volume, quantity of mass that you've created there, did you investigate a different motor technology that would have been lower mass to make it easier to control that? Because there must be enormous amounts of torque required to change directions.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, unfortunately, sound, just loves a big steam flywheel. I mean, more mass, the better. I mean, it's 100 pounds, rotating is like the ideal sound, medium. And so as soon as you get away from that, it's so hard to maintain wow and flutter specs like a disc, So to get like 0.03% wow and flutter, is just incredibly difficult on a mandrel like that. With a disc, have a big platter, just spin it, walk away, it spins beautifully, and it's an amazing technology how simple it is. So it's really just a humbling battle, to get this 90 degree thing to perform like a disc that you can just, spin with your hand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Richard Martin, Archaeophone Records, and I just wanted to say to Peter and the folks at the NEDCC and Carl, how delighted we are that that Irene is available. We've been working with a number of things that we would not be able to have transfers of whatsoever. The talking doll cylinder that was pictured there, for instance, is a great example. The misshapen metal cylinder. We'd kind of like to see Nick's machine give a shot at that.
I'm willing to try.
But
yeah. Maybe quarter speed. I'm not sure about full speed on
but
that.
That's
one.
Irene has handled that. It's brilliant. Similarly, the Edison exhibition cylinders on the National Recording Registry, the tactile transfers from 20 years ago, are exceptionally high quality, but there were some grooves that they were not able to capture. Irene was able to do that. We're also working on some of the Ishii cylinders right now. So I've seen half a dozen, 10, 12 different Irene transfers, and I can affirm that they do all have artifacts. So this is something we can work around in restoration. It's just one extra step. But the phantom noises across the spectrum are there, and those broadband things that look like cylinder swishes are in fact the seaming process where the pictures are being stitched together. And this is a known artifact of the process. It is extremely intrusive, it's hard to get rid of, but it can be achieved. And we're just grateful that we have these sounds at all to be able to work with.
Hi, for...
Hello?
For Nick, did you give any thought to turning the turntable or flywheel back horizontally so that the cylinder is playing vertically? Would that help?
Yeah, No, I've tried like every Rube Girl, sorry, Rube Goldberg contraption you can imagine. But the issue then is that then you have this huge, anti-skate, the arm wants to push down, essentially, quarter pound or something.
Well, I just wonder if overcoming that, and I'm just interested, but if overcoming that challenge might yield results than doing it this way.
Yeah, no, it's everything about switching this thing 90 degrees is a huge issue. Yeah.
If I could just add something to that, there was a British machine that did that about 15, 20 years ago, perhaps David remembers, played it vertically.
Symposium.
Symposium, that's right. I owned one at one time. It was a horror, if I may say so.
It was a horror.
Could have been the particular design, but that has been experimented with.
Yeah. Any other questions? We're happy to answer them. All right, well, thank you all very much.